from Interfaith Alliance. This is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, a Maryland high schooler sued the district over a history lesson titled "The Muslim World." Just learning about that violated her deeply held Christian beliefs, she claimed. Thankfully, a federal appeals court didn't agree. But surprisingly, with the seemingly endless research of the Christians First Thomas More Law Center at their disposal, the student and her family swear they are going to appeal and even take this to the Supreme Court if needed. Meanwhile, a court in Iowa handed the Christians First law firm Beckett Fund a victory allowing a student group at the University of Iowa to exclude a student on suspicion of his being gay. So the deeply held religious convictions of students at a secular university are safe. Oh, and the group's name? Business Leaders in Christ. God help us. This past Thursday was the first anniversary of the bloody mass shooting at Stoneman High School in Parkland, Florida. From the brutal deaths of 17 students sprang the most effective grassroots efforts at breaking our national addiction to firearms to date. As we pause to remember the precious lives lost, let us recommit to taking the necessary steps towards standing with the tireless young people who became involuntary activists on that tragic Valentine's Day 1 year ago. And the inspiring organization, September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, is marking the 17th anniversary since their founding. You've heard members of this group on State of Belief several times, and you can get involved by visiting www.peacefultomorrows.org. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Defining leadership is the art of motivating, communicating, empowering, and convincing people to engage with the new vision of sustainable development and the necessary change that this implies.
At a time when we see religion so often being used to divide, it is essential to not lose sight of the many ways faith and beliefs can help bring us closer together. For decades, Bawa Jain has devoted himself to this work on a global scale, most notably as Secretary General for the United Nations Millennium World Peace Summit of Religious and Spiritual Leaders. Today, he's busy launching the Center for Responsible Leadership, and he'll share his vision with us on this week's show.
President Trump has weighed in on the fires, taking some heat for threatening to cut off federal funds to the state.
We will get the job done. The wall is very, very on its way.
The president declares this emergency. First of all, it's not an emergency.
Officials insist reports that nearly 1,500 kids are lost are just not true.
What do you say to your critics who say that you are creating a national emergency?
Ask these incredible women who lost their daughters and their sons. Okay?
There are so many crises coming at us at once these days that it's difficult not to feel overwhelmed and to think, what can one person do anyway? The truth is, each one of us can do a lot. And the best way to reinforce that truth is to learn from those who are true change makers at whatever level they work. At the helm of Interfaith Alliance of Colorado, the Reverend Amanda Henderson has accomplished much and has just been recognized as one of Denver's top 15 change makers. She'll be with us to talk about her work later on this week's show. But first,
a six-month investigation by the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News revealed 380 cases of sexual abuse among Southern Baptist Church leaders and workers.
Another major religious organization is being roiled by a sex abuse scandal. Sadly, it wasn't internal reporting that led to public awareness, but dogged press investigations by the Houston Chronicle. As one revelation leads to another, I wanted to talk about this with my trusted friend and longtime activist, Dr. David Curry, who led the organization Texas Baptist Committed for over 20 years. And I am pleased to have him back with us on State of Belief Radio. David, welcome back to State of Belief.
Welcome. Thank you. It's nice to be back with you, even though this is a pretty sad story we're fixing to talk about.
It certainly is. How have you found yourself, David, reacting first to the revelations and second to the institutional response?
Well, the first thing I did is I read the story on Twitter, and then I put it on Facebook, and I said, folks, this is why we need a free press. What a wonderful job. Thank you, Houston Chronicle. Because self-interest keeps us from telling these things. And so this is a perfect example of the importance of the press. As you and I have known about a lot of this, Welton, for many, many years.
Yes.
I mean, when we were in that fight together trying to save the Southern Baptist Convention from where it went, from it, in my opinion, virtually abandoning the good news of Jesus Christ for legalism and fundamentalism, we knew this was going on with some of that leadership. We just, you know, didn't have the means to expose it per se. So it was a gratitude that finally this kind of stuff is coming out. We know of lawsuits going on and things that and that accompany with this. And then the second is, I remember getting phone calls from women when I was head of Texas Baptist Committed, and trying to get the denomination to deal with it, because I think the local church autonomy, which you and I understand is a bedrock of Baptist principles. Local churches have the right to make their own decisions. But to hide behind that and not putting together some sort of database for these sexual predators throughout the denomination is, that's simply not valid. It should have been done. It should have been compelled. They should have had someone to call as a local church doing its due diligence in seeking a minister, a pastor, a youth minister, or whatever. Having that central database should have been done by each state convention as well as the national convention. That does not violate local church autonomy. If that local church wants to call that person, you can't stop it. But you could have provided the information. So to hide behind that is quite concerning and wrong.
A lot of the blame for the way clergy sexual abuse has been handled by the Catholic Church has been ascribed to the hierarchical nature of that denomination. With the Southern Baptist, it's almost the opposite, isn't it? A lack of accountability due to a decentralized structure.
Exactly, and I thought of that. I mean, I thought of how ironic this is. Catholic Church is very much top down, where the Baptist Church is supposed to be bottom up, and yet they're both having the same problem. Mm-hmm. And then the Baptists are saying, well, we couldn't do anything about it because local churches are free. Well, local churches are free, but they need information. Somebody that has done this should have been identified, and that at least a place to call and check these people out. So to hide behind it, to say, well, it's a local church issue, we can't, is simply not adequate. The local church does have a right to call who it wants to. but it should be provided this kind of information readily available and compiled through the years. To read about these people going from one church to another church, changing states. I mean, one guy ended up, what, the executive vice president or whatever, the South Carolina Baptist Convention. It's unbelievable.
What role do you think the authoritarian and male-dominated nature of this enormous evangelical community played in keeping so much of this abuse secret?
Well, since my whole ministry was fighting that kind of theology and saying that it's unhealthy, you're asking a person that's going to have some very strong feelings about that. Because when you have a theology that starts with male superiority, the husband has to be the head of everything, and that anybody that gets out from underneath that husband's authority is getting outside the will of God, and this spread through these evangelical communities, and I'm talking about in the 70s. When I was a youth minister, I was running into that. And this mentality that everything has to funnel through this male hierarchy, both in the church and in the family, to where there weren't co-equal roles in relation to marriage inequality, it automatically lends itself then to a male feeling like he can get by with anything.
Yeah,
he's protected, per se. And if you're deviant, your mind took you there.
Yeah. Now that the scandal has been made public, how do you evaluate the response of leading figures in the SBC movement?
I'm only reading Baptist News Global. I'm limited in what I've read about the responses. I'm reading language that appears to be healthy, that appears to be taking things seriously. But the question is, will they put together some sort of database now, some sort of structure that says within the respect for local church autonomy, you can call us and find out. Here's another resource for you to check out these people besides just calling the former church.
Yeah.
And whether or not they're going to do that, Welton, I have not read. And so that I can't comment on something I don't know for sure what they're doing. By nature, people like to sweep things under the rug. We've watched that our whole lives.
Are you seeing in the response to all of this data, are you seeing the kind of soul-searching among the denomination's public faces that might lead to a different kind of future in terms of accountability, or is that just wishful thinking?
Russell Moore has shocked me, heading what used to be the Christian Life Commission, where you and I both worked.
Right.
I mean, I remember telling him when he was about a 23-year-old young man covering one of my Baptist meetings and wrote a hatchet story on me. I said, son, you're better than this. You know, you didn't have to write this kind of junk. Well, the kid has turned out he's not a kid anymore, but he is to you and me. But he has taken some strong stance on several issues. And I have not read a lot of what Russell has specifically said, but I am encouraged by the way I have watched him handle some other issues related to the Southern Baptist Convention.
Yeah,
the new president does not seem to be, these don't seem to be the people that are picking up the phone and calling Paige Patterson and Paul Pressler and saying, how do you want me to handle this?
Yeah.
And we know that for 20 years, that's how everything got handled.
Right.
They just call Pressler and Patterson and ask. So I'm willing to have some hope that, but when they're still so close to women ministers, when they're still so closed to gay leadership and the acceptance of people being fully Christian and in the leadership of the church, then until they can move beyond that, Welton, there's a natural reaction against fixing this.
Yeah,
in my opinion.
David, I know you and I share a deep disappointment over the obsessive focus on political power the Southern Baptist Convention has prioritized for decades now. We see that paying off in crassly partisan terms. But do you think that that kind of single-mindedness may have contributed to a neglect of pastoral and ministerial relationships that allowed this shocking level of abuse to flourish?
Well, you and I both know that the fundamentalist takeover of the Southern Baptist Convention was a political movement. It had nothing to do with inerrancy. It had nothing to do with the Bible being the Word of God. It had nothing to do with theology. And, I mean, it was a strictly power play to try to deliver the Southern Baptist Convention as a voting bloc to the Republican Party. I mean, that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, it's been successful in doing that. Now we're seeing it play out in other ways. I mean, you remember Jerry Falwell said, I look forward to the day there's not a single public school in America.
Yeah.
So we're fighting that battle now, trying to save public education in this country against the religious right movement that has no use for the genius of America, which is both religious liberty and public education.
Yeah.
So, yes, this whole everything got funneled into political power. The kingdom of God can be brought in through government, which is horrible theology. Never works, never was going to work, never will work. And but if you make that your singular focus and you teach that you're in this battle to save America, and to save it, you have to do it through a political party, then you can overlook a lot of things. I mean, look what they're overlooking in the leadership of our country right now. I mean, the ethics and morals are of no interest to the leadership of much of evangelical Christianity.
Yeah. Well, there is here a rampant authoritarianism that has caused some people to say, look, we are the only ones who know how to run this government, and you either pay attention to us or you're doing wrong and you're sending our nation down. That same kind of thinking gets transformed into personal relationships in which a person says, look, I know everything about what we ought to be doing, and you need to be paying attention to me regardless of how I am treating you. I think those two go together.
Well, they do, Wilton. I mean, we've watched these pastors come into local churches and say, you'll teach Sunday school the way I tell you to teach.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's that mentality. I have the truth and nothing but the truth. And when you invest that again in a male figure, always a male figure,
mm-hmm.
that has that authority, and the whole church is, you know, pretty much disbanded all leadership except that authoritarian leadership. That's what the fundamentalist movement is about. We've seen it in some very large churches that this has happened. It all comes out of the same mindset. When you put this person on a pedestal, you overlook a lot of things.
Dr. David Curry was the executive director of Texas Baptist Committed for 22 years. He continues his activism on many fronts and serves on the Interfaith Alliance Board of Directors. David, it's a sad story, but perhaps all of this becoming public will mean the church is a safer place to be going forward. Thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, always good to be with you, Welton. And yes, let's hope that the light that's been shed here can get rid of some darkness.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Grassroots interfaith activism, the environment we find ourselves in, is beyond challenging. But there are many opportunities as well. Interfaith Alliance of Colorado head Amanda Henderson will be back with us. And later, an ambitious initiative to restore trust in leadership. I'll talk with Bawa Jane. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Twelve80 is the name of a popular and influential lifestyle magazine and website in Denver, Colorado. When this publication recognized 15 disruptors and changemakers in the community, It was noteworthy that one of the honorees was the Reverend Amanda Henderson, Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance of Colorado. I wanted to take this opportunity to both congratulate her and also to highlight Reverend Henderson's work in that community and beyond. And so, Amanda, welcome back to State of Belief Radio and congratulations.
Thanks so much, and I'm glad to be with you again.
The focus of the write-up on your work was activism around homelessness. So let's start there. How long has that been part of your work in Denver? And I'm curious about how you got into it.
Yeah, good question. So it's actually one small piece of our large work at the Interfaith Alliance of Colorado. And as we do work doing progressive policy and assuring that religion is used for good and not for harm and not institutionalized in our laws and policies, we also started doing the work of showing the ways that our religious values can be used for the common good and to support the needs in our community. Mm-hmm. And for me, that work started shortly after I began my work at the Interfaith Alliance of Colorado almost 5 years ago, when people from the homeless community reached out to build relationships and to say, we really need people standing with us and to address policies that criminalize people for experiencing poverty and homelessness. And as we started addressing those policy needs, we also started to notice that there was a need for real creativity in how we address our shared issues and intractable problems. And we saw that the skills that we bring in bringing people together across different religious backgrounds, where we bring people to the table who are coming from different backgrounds, whether that be mm-hmm. city leaders or foundations or service providers or radical grassroots activists working to support people experiencing homelessness, that through bringing everyone to the table and bringing our ways of being as interfaith, we were able to really work for material change in our community grounded out of our values in creative ways. And it's gained a lot of traction. It's made a difference in people's lives and also helped people notice that some of the assumptions that we have about religion, quote unquote, actually can look different than we expect.
So what other issues work that way for interreligious activists in Colorado?
You know, we work in a lot of issues, and that specific work that we've done around homelessness has also helped us see that we know that we have a crisis in housing in Colorado, housing prices, and that's homelessness is one piece of that, but it's a bigger problem. And we notice that faith communities have a lot of resources. We calculated that faith communities have over 5,000 acres of land in the Denver metro area alone that is underutilized. And so by asking faith communities, how can you reach into your mission and vision to serve the common good with a real commitment to the common good, not any other agenda? And through that work, we've started a project of walking with faith communities who decide to use their land or give their land to build housing, to support the community, to assure that those most in need have that basic necessity of a roof and a community that cares about them. So that's been one other way that we've been able to address a common concern. We also have started to look at different economic justice issues and looking at the systemic ways that economic disparity and inequality impacts every one of us. And how can we come together and think creatively about how we start to bridge those economic divides and change both the systems and our decision making from day to day and how we use our resources. So those are a couple of the ways.
The challenges can seem beyond overwhelming. You know how to do this, so please mm-hmm. talk to us about that.
Mm-hmm. You know, the first step to me was listening, and is always to listen, and to get to know the people and to get to know the landscape and to get to know the issues and the places of pain and the places of joy in the work and in the community. So as the Interfaith Alliance of Colorado and my work there, I really spent that first year getting to know both the history of the organization, the people who were a part of it, and what the real needs were in the community and how we might bring our gifts to those needs. And so through that listening, I came to really understand that as an organization, interfaith is who we are. We come as people who are each deeply rooted in different traditions. And what we do is political advocacy that's grounded in our shared values for human rights and equality. And that advocacy both looks like doing education and learning and building relationships across our differences, engaging. And that's really the long haul heart work to mm-hmm. me, is building those relationships across the differences. And then we work for that systemic policy change through building relationships with decision makers and understanding the issues and connecting our diverse constituents to be empowered and educated and know how they can make their voice heard to that policy place. The third leg of what we do, we say we do education and advocacy, and this third leg is the catalyzing social change. And I think for us, that's been one of the unique places where we take the skills from the other two places of understanding policy and systemic change and being rooted in relationships to address the material, kind of tangible work that needs to be done in order to improve the people's lives around us. And that has been the most creative edge of our work and the really fun area. And honestly, it's garnered a lot of attention because people can see it and feel it. And that's been the work that we've done around homelessness and the Congregation Land Campaign. And for us, these three are inseparable, because we need to be building relationships. We need to be working for long haul systemic change, and we need to be doing things that we can see and feel to improve our lives. And we see each of these as grounded in this using the values and the lessons from our multiple faith traditions to be a part of the common good. And that is really challenges some of the assumptions of what we have come to see religion in the public sphere as. And so we're trying to build a new way of being religious in the public sphere that is grounded in pluralism and religious freedom and diversity and equity and inclusion, and showing this is what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. Amanda, you are particularly effective in getting out the message about your work on social media. Mm-hmm. Would you talk a little bit about how you harness that resource and what kinds of results you see from it?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we've realized in this time is a lot of organizing that it is grounded in relationship is vital, and our base of people who share our values is so much more broad than we can ever reach through traditional religious partnerships. But there are a lot of people who aren't necessarily a part of a traditional religious community, but are hungry for both stories and ways to engage in our shared values around human rights and equity and opportunity for all people. So through social media, through telling the stories, through creating opportunities for people to get involved, to make their voice heard with platforms like Facebook, Twitter, mm-hmm. Instagram, as well as doing short video clips of being able to tell the story. I think that that's really how we build culture change, and is through telling the story and putting real thought into that and learning how to be clear and concise and effective in sharing these stories is a vital piece of the work.
Hmm. I know you're speaking to us from New York City, where you're taking part in an event organized by our good friends at Auburn Seminary. I wish you'd talk about the project you're there for just a minute or two.
Absolutely. So I'm here as a part of a project that they're doing here at Auburn around reparations. And during the 200-year anniversary of Auburn Seminary, they discovered some more details of their institutional history around racism and slavery that they are seeking to learn how to make right. And so the institution is embarking on kind of a long-term project around reparations. Today, I'm involved in a piece of that project doing a Fearless Dialogue workshop. So we're doing activities and working together. People have come from across the country and from Auburn to talk about how we do this work, how we engage in reconciling and repairing the broken history of slavery and racism that is so deeply embedded in every aspect of our lives. And if we're going to bring real change, we have to engage in the deep personal and interpersonal work, as well as, you know, really imagining how we change our resources and how we put money behind reparations.
Mm-hmm.
So today is the first step of building these relationships and engaging in the dialogue toward the next actions.
Please tell our listeners how they can follow the work of Interfaith Alliance of Colorado and how they can support that work.
Wonderful. You can check out our website at interfaithallianceco.org. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by looking up Interfaith Alliance CO or of Colorado. And we are grateful the work, the financial support that we receive from people in Colorado and across the country really helps to lift up the voices of people from multiple faith backgrounds who are working to improve our communities and change our culture to where we really can live into this deeply held value of religious freedom in ways that it was meant to be spoken.
The Reverend Amanda Henderson is Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance of Colorado, a position she's held since 2014. Last month, Denver Lifestyle Magazine 1280 recognized her as one of the city's leading 15 disruptors. Amanda, thank you so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. Well, I'm glad to be here.
Bawa Jane has been a peacemaker and an interfaith activist for decades. We know each other dating back to his work launching the United Nations Millennium World Peace Summit of Religious and Spiritual Leaders. Characteristically taking on the biggest challenges of our time, Bawa is now deeply engaged in launching the Center for Responsible Leadership. And I am very pleased to have him join me on State of Belief Radio. Bawa, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Reverend Welton. And by the way, you know, you were in the leadership of the Millennium Summit. You were on the advisory.
What are the global challenges that you're trying to overcome with the Center for Responsible Leadership?
Reverend Welton, you've been at the heartbeat of all that is happening in the last few years in our capital, when there's so much partisanship. I never thought in my life that I would see such polarization in our country with our leadership. And, you know, this is the world's greatest country, the best country. I would never want to be anywhere else. But it's dismal to see what has transpired. It's a spiral down, really. And I take it back. I think really started to spiral downwards ever since the election of President Obama, I think that the country, there were people here who was just not willing to see a black man with a middle name Hussein being the most powerful man in the world. This is my own conviction. I may be wrong. But I think what motivates me is that I feel there's a vacuum of responsible leadership. So that is what's motivated me to see how we can put our interests aside in the larger interest of our country and indeed the world.
So what is the center's mandate?
Well, center is an independent body, and you know, we are starting this new initiative. And we begin by asking three simple questions. The questions we ask is, are you making decisions based on the present or the future? Are your decisions based on conviction or convenience? Are those decisions constructive or destructive? You can see more on our website, thecrl.org, www.thecrl.org.
What kind of partnerships are you having to leverage in order to make this happen?
What motivates me most is working with situations where there is difficulty and there are challenges. If we're only working with people who all agree with us, or they're all speaking the same language, I'm really not interested. So we are seeking out those people who have had challenges in their lifetimes, whether it is the people or the countries or the institutions, and bringing them out forward to see how they are dealing with looking at the larger interests out of the three questions that we are asking in the interest of their own organization, the country, or the corporation, or whatever position that they hold. So at the first summit, we are going to have the first inaugural summit will take place at the United Nations April 29th and 30th. And we are assembling only about 100 of the very few selected leaders in the first instance to come together to, you know, have a good, robust debate on this subject and then see what we can commit to in the larger interest of our country and indeed the world.
What would be a success in that meeting?
To me, a success, I want to set ourselves very modest goals, though my aspirations are very high. Modest goals would be that there would be commitment to ongoing monitoring and launching some new initiatives. Monitoring, I mean, to measuring success, to see what really came out. Some tangible outcomes to come from here. We have a few that we are working on, and there will be short-term and long-term both. And then we would look to seeing that out of these 100, who are the people who we can call upon to take leadership, whether in one part of the world or one issue, but the larger framework of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, the commonly known goals, SDGs.
Yeah. Could you have envisioned the degree of divisiveness and distrust that we're seeing today?
Absolutely not. It makes me sick to my stomach to see where we have come. That was almost like a high point. We had in excess of 2,000 people, over 1,200 of them in senior religious leaders from over 120 countries. And if they could overcome the differences, we could launch a common commitment to peace, to global action at the United Nations. And then this, we come to this, it is absolutely horrible. But that just means that we know that our work is cut out for us. And, it pains me also that I've been very active with a lot of the civil rights leaders in this country. Following the close contemporaries of Reverend Martin King, Martin Luther King, as commonly known, but in their circles they call him Reverend Martin King, and they made a comment to me last year. One of them, Reverend Dr. C.T. Vivian, I was with him. You remember him? Our old friend.
Yes.
We were in Atlanta together, and he says, "Baba, it pains me to say that we are back to the days of segregation. We know that we have our work cut out for us." I mean, it was just so saddening to hear that kind of tone. So, yes, we have spiraled downwards, not upwards. And we need to do something. And that's why we are launching the Center for Responsible Leadership, to bring some of those leaders who are willing to make those courageous and bold decisions and help transform the way we are conducting ourselves.
Talk a little bit more about the kind of work that you want the Center for Responsible Leadership to be doing.
You know, one of the greatest challenges is that we have a trust deficit now. So we want to mobilize leaders to help start inspiring and rebuilding trust. We must restore civility to public discourse. This kind of conduct, what is going on today, is unacceptable. This whole, did you ever hear a time when the leader of the free world, the president here, would start, you know, calling, or even many of his contemporaries and associates, this whole notion of fake news and alternate truths? Mm. I mean, the media is the backbone of our democracy, of our societies. They are the moral conscience, supposed to be bringing out issues which sometimes are difficult to tackle with. And when you start to erode trust in the media, you are eroding trust in the very foundations of democracy. We must restore that kind of language. This is, you know, everybody should be held to a higher standard of responsibility, especially those of people who are in positions of influence and power. So we want to, you know, at the Center for Responsible Leadership, reward those people who have taken those courageous decisions. Seek out those who are willing to go down that path. And as you and me know, there are people who are successful in life. They love to impart their own experiences and advice to people who are the young people who will be in the positions of leadership in the years to come. So we want that the established leaders today are willing to meet these young leaders at their crossroads and help share their experiences, that hopefully they can avoid the pitfalls that some of us sometimes have had to fall into.
Bawa, tell me again the three major questions that you ask as you go into this work.
The three questions we ask is simple ones for each one of us to reflect on ourselves is, number one, do you make decisions based on the present or the future? Number two, are your decisions based on conviction or convenience? And number three, are the decisions constructive or destructive? Mm. Ask that for yourself, Wilton, of yourself. You had quite a challenge of two in your life. See how you conducted yourself. I'm a great admirer of all that you have done in your life and continue to do.
Well, you're very kind in saying that, but the reason I wanted you to go at those questions again is because I agree with you and support you in your work that you're beginning with Center for Responsible Leadership, and you're going to be dealing with really people who are in leadership positions. I am of the opinion that we also need to be doing the same thing with the people who go to work every day, who don't see themselves as leaders at all. And they are the people also that can turn this thing around. And the questions that you ask, and I wanted you to ask them again, those questions belong to all of us, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. One thing which I urge everybody to remember, none of us are inadequate. Each one of us can make a difference. We have to begin to believe in ourselves and trust ourselves. There is nobody to judge you how big or how small your actions are. Every bit counts. Every bit matters. So ask yourself these questions. Number one, do you make decisions based on the present or the future? Number two, do you make decisions based out of conviction or is it convenience? And number three, are those decisions constructive or destructive? There's nobody judging you here. And do not feel inadequate. Each one of us can and must contribute to whatever little bit we can. Remember, Mandela was one person. Martin Luther King was one person. Gandhi was one person. And look what they did, what they transformed. Let us be, you know, inspired by them. Give ourselves, you know, enough credit and have the conviction that we can indeed make a difference. Hmm. That we are not here to see there's somebody standing in judgment of us. ultimately it is a Lord and a Creator who holds us in judgment. Let's just be answerable to that divine power which guides and nurtures each one of us. Remember, again, the two greatest commandments, which I think we oftentimes forget, to me, they should be the central of any mission that we are engaged in. Love your neighbor as yourself. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Ask yourself, do you really do that? Do we do that?
Tell our listeners how they can learn more about what you're doing and how, if they wish to get involved in your work, how can they get involved?
One is, please visit the website www.thecrl.org and you can register there. And as we come out with specific things, we will begin to start sharing. If you are interested in somehow being a mentor or a mentee, please send us those details. Because ultimately, we want to build a large database of mentors and start matching them up with mentees. One day, I dream of this being a global database, one of the biggest ones in the world, where and a robust, secure one, where people can seek advice from within their own sectors, from across the world, or within their own countries, in their own communities. That's one. Second is, we hope that we will launch some educational programs, and one day I pray it can be even at the earliest levels. Because what we are launching here, Welton, is that I think in the next, say, 10, 20 years, maybe not in my lifetime, I pray, though it is, that the responsible leadership, the way we envision it, should just be part of our DNA. So let's begin by, you know, addressing some of the major challenges that are, that we are confronting right now. For instance, the issues of climate control. Okay, we know global warming is a reality, yet some people choose to deny it. Look at the recent couple of weeks and see what the temperatures in the USA hit. Arctic temperatures in Chicago and New York and elsewhere, all across. And yet we'd say that, you know, the weather is not being impacted. I think then we are being foolish to ourselves and not facing the reality that we must take action and do something about it. So we will continue to monitor what are the issues. We want to be proactive rather than reactive, and have people in positions of leadership be the ones, because ultimately, you know, to my mind, change comes from positions of leadership and authority, because they can communicate to the masses. And in this context, one of the greatest untapped resources remains, I think, for the foreseeable future, the religious and spiritual leaders. You know, the Pew poll has it that about 90% of the world follows one religion or the other. Oftentimes, the religious leaders do not have adequate knowledge of these complex issues. For me, the SDGs are too complex. A common person on the street cannot understand them. So we need to have people who are within, who will be coming to the summit, take on whatever SDG is relevant in their community, simplify to a language where a common person can understand. Because until we build this as a global movement, we will not succeed. So let's transform this movement and make it a global movement that each one of us can take some action.
Bawa Jain is a longtime interfaith leader, educator, peacemaker, and activist. Today, he's leading the effort to launch the badly needed Center for Responsible Leadership. We'll link to more resources from stateofbelief.com. Bawa, I hope that you will keep us informed in what you're doing. We are interested in it and want to be supportive of it. It's great to see you continuing your important work. And thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton, and I seek your blessings as always. It's all such a pleasure to hear you, and I look forward to seeing you someday soon.
Before we go, over the past 5 years or so, I have heard numerous disturbing, often frightening comments from leaders at the highest levels of our government, and reports on decisions they've made and actions they've taken that threaten the integrity of our democracy. Numerous actions have been downright wrong, as well as diametrically contradictory to both the spirit and the law of our first freedom, I'm talking about religious liberty. Now comes this. Dominique Ray, convicted of three murders, was scheduled for execution by lethal injection by the state prison of Alabama in the second week of February. As a convert to Islam, the prisoner requested that his spiritual advisor be with him at the time of his death. The prisoner's request for his imam to be with him in the killing room was denied. Prison officials said it would be a security risk to let someone who was not an employee of the correction department be present in the execution room. Only the Christian chaplain at the prison could provide spiritual support. Ray challenged Alabama's ruling. That decision in Alabama went to the highest court in our land in Washington, D.C. Moving quickly, the United States Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, refused to overturn the Alabama ruling. Ray was executed alone with his imam in another room from which he watched the prisoner die. When that news report was broadcast on my television set, I gasped and then hurt and then felt fury. In the United States, this man's religious rights were cruelly violated. Yes, I said man. To have been found guilty of the brutal killing of three innocent human beings, to have been convicted of murder by our cherished system of justice, and to have been condemned to the ultimate punishment allowed by law makes him a person whose life will be taken in the name of all of us. But he's still a man and still entitled to the protections we all have. The United States Supreme Court allowed this to happen, indeed gave its blessing for an individual's religious right to spiritual comfort at the time of his death to be denied. In her dissent, Justice Elaine Kagan pointed out that the clearest command of the Establishment Clause in our Constitution is that one religious denomination cannot be officially preferred over another. And of course, the state of Alabama does not have the authority to overrule the Constitution of the United States. The prevailing justices on the court weakly explained that the prisoner waited too long to request the presence of his imam, and they didn't want the execution to have to be changed to another time. At the request of the prisoner to be killed, the Christian chaplain was not allowed into the execution chamber. I cannot get out of my mind representatives of the nation that was founded on the principle of religious freedom denied a man the right to the comfort of religion at the time of his last breath. Journalist, lawyer, and playwright Wajahat Ali wrote a sad, moving story published in The Atlantic of what happened in Atlanta that evening. What message was spewed around the world? That Islam is inferior to Christianity? Honestly, what do you think would have happened if the prisoner had been a Christian rather than a Muslim? For the whole world to see our judicial system denied the right of religious freedom in the name of the Constitution, why would a Muslim not feel hostile to Christianity when majoritarian Christians want only Christians to have religious freedom exemptions based on deeply held beliefs and even comfort at the time of their death. What's next? Who knows? Both of the most recent additions to the Supreme Court were nominated by a president who called for a ban against Muslims coming to this country. How long until constitutional privileges are granted only to Christians? Will the religious right demand such liberties be extended only to Christians who believe the right doctrines? Look, I say all of this as a lifelong Christian and an ordained Christian minister. It was not so long ago that it seemed most of us agreed that a key responsibility of the dominant majority was scrupulous attention to the rights of those in the minority. And it has always been true that our system of laws would hardly be needed if everything was handled according to simple majority rules policies. If it all came down to might makes right, it's not how we treat the privileged and the powerful that reveals our character. It's how we treat the most odious, the most repugnant, and the most marginalized, even those who deem worthy of putting to death. On January 16, 2019, Religious Freedom Day, Donald Trump pledged, I'm quoting, to protect religious liberty and to seek justice against those who seek to abridge it. A few days later, on February 7, 2019, Dominique Ray was executed by the state of Alabama after being denied his request for the presence of the comfort of a religious person before he died. That makes me sick. And it heightens my fear that our country may soon no longer enjoy religious freedom for all. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support of this program helps keep us on the air week after week. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say thank you on behalf of every one of our listeners. If you think there's value in what you've heard right here, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.